Listen, let me welcome everybody back this morning. Anybody that needs a workbook, just raise your hand. We have, I think, enough for everybody to have one of these. And today, let me look at your workbook. We're going to be starting on page 5. We're going to be picking, you might push up a little hotter than that. Just a little further, a little further, a little further. Okay, is that okay for everybody about like that? Good. Let's just leave the PA system right there, and I think we'll be in good shape. Listen, because I've got a whole lot of stuff to say, we don't have a whole lot of time to say it in, we're going to get down to business here, and we're going to try to move as quickly as we can this morning. And I will try to, if I can here anyways, try to give everybody just a couple more minutes to get in here. Whoops. There we go. You know, I am so technically challenged. When I run out of gas in the car, I'll start thinking about trading. I have no ability. It was so funny when the kids were small. I would be sitting on the floor playing a game with the kids, and if the game or the toy broke, the child wouldn't even speak to me. They'd just get up and walk in there to Mama, and Mama would fix it. And I just have no ability on technical things. So I love these guys that come in here and know how to operate the PA systems and the video systems and all of that. Listen, I don't know about where you come from, but where I come from, things are pretty simple. I come from Nashville. You might have heard the story about the old guy. He was not much of a husband. This old guy was just a wishy-washy, kind of willy-nilly, kind of limp-wristed guy. Yes. Are we out of workbooks? Well, that's all I had that were in that box. I'm sorry if we're out. If there are some of you in here that maybe a couple that could share one, that would be nice. Those of you here, there's a lady here that needs one. And I think there's a couple there that if there's an extra one, we could use that. And I will try my best to sort of stay with that workbook as much as we can. By the way, the workbook that you have is the workbook that we use at the seminars around the country. And I'm kind of picking and choosing a few tidbits from the seminar that I'm using for this shortened version of this. And really what we did yesterday, we kind of opened with what is normally session number 1. Those were the first 5 pages of that, or the first 4 pages, I guess I should say, of your workbook. Today we're going to be picking up on page 5, the ABCs of Godly Money Management. Listen, what I started to tell you about a while ago was this. You may have heard the story about this guy. He was a limp-wristed, kind of wishy-washy, kind of willy-nilly guy. And his poor old wife, she just couldn't take this any longer. Finally, one day she looked at him and she said, "Listen, I have had it with this." Whoops, there goes my mic. "I have had it with this marriage." And he says, "Well, honey dear, what in the world's wrong?" She says, "That's what's wrong. You're not much of a man. You're kind of wishy-washy, kind of willy-nilly." He said, "Well, honey, what do you think we ought to do about this?" She said, "Well, I'll tell you what we need to do about it. We need to get some counseling. We need to get some help." He said, "Well, honey, you just schedule something. I'll come right along." She says, "Okay, I'll do it. I'll do it." So she schedules an appointment with a counselor, and about a week later they go to see this guy, and they're sitting there talking to the counselor, and it doesn't take the counselor very long to see what the problem is. And he gets a little bit disgusted. He gets up from behind his desk, walks around to the front of his desk, and he grabs the woman by her shoulders, right shoulder, left shoulder, stands this chick up in front of him, throws his arms around her, and gives her the biggest kiss she's ever had in her life. Mwah! Sits her back down, walks back around, looks at the husband, says, "Now listen, sport, that's what your wife needs at least twice every week." Kind of looked at him and said, "Well, I reckon I could get her in here on Tuesdays and Thursdays." Folks, there are some things in this world, if you're going to do them, you've got to do them yourself. And gentlemen, at the very top of that list is kissing your own wife. You're in charge of that job. Nobody else is in charge of that. And I'm going to need to be walking around in front of here, so I'm going to push these cords back so hopefully I don't trip over feet or cords in the process. But at the top of the list for all of those of you in here of the male persuasion who happen to be married, kissing your own wife is your job. Nobody else is involved in that process. But for all of us in this room, near the top of our list should be learning how to deal with our money. Because the hard reality is this. When you find someone else out there who is as interested in your money as you are, you might want to think about getting away from them real, real fast. Because the truth is, they're probably not as interested in your money for your purposes as they are for their own purposes. David, is everything doing okay there? Okay. So, this morning, what we're going to do is we're going to kick off with what I call the ABC session of Godly Money Management. And I will tell you this. We're not going to have enough time in here to do the C. What we're going to do this morning, we're going to do the A and the B. Tomorrow we're going to come back and do the C, because the C is, in my judgment, the more interesting portion of this, but it's also the more time-consuming. Now, what this also means, and I explained this to those of you that were with us yesterday, what this also means is, unfortunately, I don't have time to do the full No Debt, No Sweat seminar. Now, there are a number of you, and I've already met and bumped into several of you, who have been at seminars that we've done. Hey, from Sarasota to Sacramento, and from San Diego up to Delaware and every place in between. We've done, I think, the seminar that I finished last Tuesday of this week, Monday night of this week in Tacoma, was our 235th No Debt, No Sweat seminar. And again, as I told the audience yesterday, this has nothing to do with this messenger. It has everything, though, to do with the message. The reality is we Christians are in a world of pain when it comes to money. Over 70% of us, and elders, listen to me carefully on this. Because elders, a lot of times, you don't know this. And it's not your fault. Elders as a group of people tend to be, and by the way, let me invite everybody right now while I'm thinking about it. Everybody take your left finger just like this. Hold your left finger up just like this. And now reach inside your pocket or your purse and pull out your cell phone, okay? And take your cell phone and push that finger right into the off button, okay? So we don't have cell phones ringing this morning. Everybody do that real quickly, if you will, please. What I was starting to say, though, is this. Elders need to understand something. And this is no reflection, and no negative reflection on elders at all. Elders don't know this sometimes for two reasons. Number one, and then what I'm talking about to be specific, is elders don't understand some of the financial struggles their people are dealing with. A lot of elders say, oh, yes, we do. Well, the truth is, for every one you know about, there's probably 5 or 10 people in that church that are struggling. People will come to you. Every one of you elders know what it's like to be blindsided by some couple that will walk into a meeting and plop down at the table and announce that they're about to get a divorce. And you didn't even know they were having troubles because they have aggressively hidden that fact. Well, folks, when people hide things from you, you're not mind readers. You can't know what's going on. So elders don't know the fact that so many people are aggressively hiding money problems in their churches. And there's a second reason why elders are not as clued in on this as they it would be good for them to be. And that's because elders tend to be good men, people who have done a pretty good job themselves of raising their families, leading their households, handling their finances, and so forth. But I'm telling you, across the board in churches today, as we mentioned yesterday, over 70% of Christians are in financial trouble. The truth is, as I mentioned yesterday, the average Christian today is giving God just a little over 2% of his income. And on average, many of us are spending up to 20% of our income paying off short-term, high-interest-rate, credit card-type debt. I'm convinced that this is what's destroying the church in many ways, because we're so tied up, we're so worried, we're so stressed with our spouses and with our inability to take care of our financial things. We can't travel lightly for Jesus. And if God puts it on our heart, hey, why don't we go on a 2-week mission trip? Why don't we do this? I mean, there's no chance of being able to, because we have these stresses and these struggles that we're struggling with. So this is what No Debt, No Sweat speaks to. Normally when I do the No Debt, No Sweat seminar, we do 4 sessions. The first session is sort of what we did yesterday. The second session is what we're going to be doing today and tomorrow. These 2 sessions today and tomorrow really constitute session number 2, the ABCs. But then the other 2 sessions that I'm not even going to have time to get into here at Tulsa, the third session is the debt session. That's when I give people a 7-step do-it-yourself credit repair kit. I show people how to honorably get out of their debt and deal with their debts. We talk about how credit cards work, how to get out of credit card bondage. And again, for those of you in here that always ask, no, I'm not Dave Ramsey. Dave Ramsey is a friend of mine. We live in the same neighborhood. I like Dave. Dave and I agree on about 80% of what each other teaches. But there are some things that are different. I'm not into the health, wealth, and prosperity theology. I don't have any problem with Christians that have money, but I can't tell you that God expects you to be a millionaire. On the other, and also different from Dave, I don't think that it's necessarily a sin to own a credit card. But in that third session, I show Christians how to deal with their credit cards so their credit cards don't deal with them. Because for a lot of us, those credit cards are not plastic prosperity, they're plastic explosives. And I'm showing people how to deal with them. Also in that third session, I show folks how to get rid of their car loan. The average person in America today has got a car loan that's 63 months long. They're paying nearly $400 a month. And when that sucker's gone, they're going to get another one. It's these car loans and credit cards that keep beating us up. And when Christians are spending 105% of what they make each year, it's little wonder that we don't know how to give. And that's why the next generation, the teens, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, have never learned how to give in our churches. And that's what's going on. That's what we do in the third session. The fourth and final session, again, this is one that I will not have time to do here in Tulsa, but in the fourth session, that's when we talk very clearly about getting ahead. And this is my favorite session. It's the one when we talk about the six secrets of the world's great investors. Simple things most people don't understand, but when we apply them, they change our lives, they change our legacies for the better. I teach Christians how mutual funds work. We talk about the difference between God's investment approach and Satan's investment approach, which is one that's based on greed. That's what we normally do at a No Debt, No Sweat seminar. And I always feel like when I come to a lectureship or do this at one of the universities or do it at Red River or Blue Ridge or do it here at Tulsa, I always feel halfway apologetic because I don't have time to really explain what this whole thing is about and what we try to do in churches. But today we are going to launch with this second session. And to get started, I don't know any place to start with an ABC list except with A. I mean, it just seems natural. So let's start there. Mr. Jackson was a 55-year-old businessman. He had loved the Lord all of his life. He had been a Christian all of his life. But probably more than anything else in this world, Mr. Jackson loved mission work. He loved mission work. He loved missionaries. And he was just passionate about this. But there was this one young missionary that he loved the very most. This young man lived in Tanzania. He lived in Africa, worked in Tanzania. And Mr. Jackson and this young man had a bond. It was almost a father-son bond. It was like a Paul and Timothy sort of relationship. Well, anyways, this was that very special day that only occurred every couple of years. The young missionary was back in the United States for a couple of weeks of vacation, and today was the day he was coming to visit Mr. Jackson at his place of business. The young man was excited. He pulled his car into Mr. Jackson's property, and again, he was impressed by the acres of manufacturing facilities. He pulled up to the corporate headquarters building, went up to the 10th floor where Mr. Jackson's suite of offices was. The elevator had no more than opened its door when Mr. Jackson's secretary looked down the hall. She saw the young man. She was excited. She got up from her chair, walked into Mr. Jackson's offices, and said, "Mr. Jackson, he's here." And with that, Mr. Jackson was up from behind the big mahogany desk, walking to the door of his office. And he got to the door of his office just as the young missionary arrived. And it really was a father and son moment. The two men just embraced. And finally, Mr. Jackson said, "Come over here, sit down. I want to hear about everything that's gone on in Tanzania for the last couple of years." So for the next 3 or 4 hours, the two men sat and talked. The young missionary told Mr. Jackson about people who were coming to Christ, people who were being baptized into Jesus. He told them about their dream of starting a medical outreach so they could address people's physical needs as well as their spiritual needs. Well, anyways, the day had drug on, and it was time for the two men to say goodbye. So by this point, Mr. Jackson and the young missionary are back at the door of his office. They're saying their very last goodbye when Mr. Jackson turns and starts to walk back to his desk. Now, the young missionary, he knew what Mr. Jackson was going to do because every time he'd ever come to see Mr. Jackson before, Mr. Jackson had done this. He would walk back to his desk and he would pull open the drawer and pull out his big personal 3-to-a-page black checkbook. Lay it on the desk, open it up, and write a check, usually for $2,000 or $3,000 extra just to help the young missionary with his medical, or not his medical needs, but with his personal needs. Well, anyways, this day Mr. Jackson did the same thing. He pulled out the checkbook, filled out a check, walked back over and handed it to the missionary. The missionary, when he took the check, he just glanced at it and he looked at it again, and he finally looked at Mr. Jackson and he said, "I don't get it." He said, this is a check for $50,000. He said, "I don't understand." Mr. Jackson said, "Listen," he said, "we're having a pretty good year this year. There's no big deal here. I can afford this. And besides, if you're ever going to get that medical outreach going, I want to help with it, and it's going to take some serious money. I want to be participatory, so enjoy the check." So again, the two men were saying their very last goodbye when the telephone over here on Mr. Jackson's credenza rang. Mr. Jackson picked the phone up, and what had been a very, very positive look on his face just began to evaporate. It dissolved. Mr. Jackson said, are you sure it's that bad? He said, call every member of the board. I want them in town by tomorrow morning. Have my management team here in 15 minutes. Hung up the phone. Young missionary said, well, what in the world just happened? Mr. Jackson said, I don't know fully, but apparently the ship that's coming up from South America that's bringing all of next year's raw rubber supply is somewhere out in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's taking on water. He said, if that ship were to go down, he said, it's not insured if it were to go down. He said, this time next year we'll be bankrupt. He said, I need to ask you, could I please have that check back? Young missionary said, well, sure. He reached in his pocket and pulled out the check, handed it to Mr. Jackson. Mr. Jackson took the check back. He took the check, he tore it in half, and he threw it away. But at least he walked back over to his desk, and he opened up the checkbook again, jotted out another check, ripped it out, handed it to the young man. Folks, this time when the young man looked at the check, his knees almost buckled. He said, I don't get it. He said, a minute ago you gave me $50,000? But he said, this time you've written me a check for $100,000. He said, I don't get it. Folks, that was the day the young missionary learned the lesson of his life. Mr. Jackson said, look, he said, a minute ago, I was flying pretty high here. But he said, what's going on right now? This thing is just between God and me. And I need for God to know where my heart is. Now, brothers, sisters, I don't know a clearer way of saying it, but I would submit to you that it is virtually impossible for a Christian to get his heart right with God without also getting his money right with God. So what I'd like to do here for a few minutes is I'd like to share with you a few of the fundamental principles that God's kids have always understood about giving. And don't anybody in here come up and say, oh, Steve, that's old Mosaical law. No, actually, what I'm going to be teaching on predates Moses. Some of this goes back to the days of Melchizedek. But these are three things that God's kids have always understood about giving. First thing is simply this. They have understood that God expects us to give to Him from our first fruits. In Proverbs, we're told about this. Honor the Lord from your wealth and from the first of all of your produce. And why is that? So that your barns will be filled with plenty, your vats will overflow with new wine. First fruit giving is talked about in both the Old and the New Testament. It's mentioned more than 20 times in the Bible. The truth of the matter is this is not deep, tough theology. It doesn't take a theology degree to explain this. This is simple stuff, again, that God's kids have always understood. It's the belief, it's the understanding that simply says God gets the first, God gets the best. Folks, this is why it was wrong for the Jews to come to the temple with a lamb that was damaged, that was lame, or that was blemished. God expected the best. And I would tell you this, listen, it's equally wrong for Christians these days to come to church on Sunday morning and wait until the collection basket's going by and pop our billfolds open to see what we've got left to decide what God gets. It's the same thing. This is wrong. We don't need to be this way. Now again, it's real easy for me to teach this stuff. It's a different thing for me to live it. And I can tell you that I haven't always done as well as I wish I had at this. 25, 30 years ago, Bonnie and I noticed something. We noticed that we would sometimes get all excited about some need. Maybe it was a missionary. Maybe it was some kid wanting to go to school or something. But before we gave the money, we'd kind of forget. Or we'd spend it on something else. Or we would kind of lose our interest. Something that really helped us, we went down to First Tennessee Bank, this has been almost three decades ago, and opened up a savings account that we call, and we still have it to this day, our First Fruits account. And the plan was real simple. We would take money that we had left over in our checking account and put it into this savings account. So we were, like the Bible says, ready unto every good work. When a missionary came around, when a mission calls came up, maybe it was just the mama that needed a bag of groceries. We always were able to give. And it really changed things. Now listen, I want to be very careful about something. Listen carefully to this. I am not recommending or suggesting that my theology is that we take all the money we have left over in our checking account, put it in a savings account, and wait for God to tap us on the shoulder and say, hey Steve, now's the time to give. I'm not saying this. This money in our first fruits account was the money that was over and above our regular giving. I really do believe that the way Christians need to give today is essentially the way we are giving. I think at regular intervals, Sunday mornings is when we usually do it, we need to give. We need to be regular, participatory, ongoing, involved, informed givers at the church where we go. Now, sometimes people say, well, Steve, I just don't think I agree with what those elders are doing with my money. Hey, listen to me. Listen carefully. If you're going to a church where those elders are committing outright sin with your money, don't give it. And for that matter, don't even go to that church. But you know, about 99.something% of the time, when we get into these stupid arguments about how the money gets used, it doesn't have anything to do with spiritual issues. It boils down to issues of preference and pride. That's what it boils down to. And I'm telling you something, listen carefully to me. Nobody's asked me to say this. This is from me. When a man loves God enough to belly up to the bar and say, okay, I will help lead this church. I'll be one of the shepherds. Then we, as Christian members of that church, need to undergird, support, underwrite, and encourage that man. That means that as Christians, we need to be ready to pick up and go when our elders find a new direction. When our elders say, let's go this way, we need to get involved. We need to get involved emotionally, financially, physically. We need to get involved in every way. That means on Sunday mornings when the collection basket comes by, we are regular contributors, ongoing contributors to the church, wherever our church home is. It's funny, on Sunday mornings when I'm traveling, I'm always at a different church. I can always tell when the collection basket comes by. They know there's this guy here who's going to talk about money, and I can kind of see people watching to see what I put in the collection basket. I don't usually put anything in, because Bonnie's at home putting our money in at the Antioch Church in Nashville. That's our home church. You see, when you're on vacation, you don't forget your church. Now, sometimes I'll put a dollar in to be seen of men, but that's a joke. I don't really do it. No, we need to be giving wherever we're going. I got to looking at this a while back. Did you know that only 9% of Christians nationwide are tithing Christians? Less than 10% of Christians are giving 10% of their money to God. Now, I know what some of you in here may already be thinking. You're thinking, is that guy up there in that tacky shirt about ready to tell me how much I'm supposed to give? And if so, where does he find that in the Bible? And no, I'm not going to tell you what to give. That's none of my business. Maybe your elders can. I can't do it. And no, I can't go to some spot in the New Testament and point at it and say, that's where it says we have to tithe. And yes, I think that some of our friends in other families of faith, in some cases, have taught tithing too legalistically. Just like we have taught a few things too legalistically. Amen? But really, I got to thinking about this tithing thing a long time ago. I got to thinking, you know, if God's kids in the Old Testament were tithing, and they were, actually they were doing a lot more than that. You start studying it, and you find out that with the temple taxes and everything else, they were probably giving closer to 30 or 35% of their income. But that gets real close to meddling, so I won't go there. Let's just stay with that 10% thing. If in the Old Testament times, God's kids were tithing, I got to thinking, why don't we do the same thing today? I mean, good night. They were living under the law of Moses. Today, yippee skippy, I'm living under the gift of grace in Jesus. Why would I want to do less than those guys? And something else. Those people weren't living like we were. I meant to mention something earlier, and I forgot to tell you this. I meant to tell you that I'm rich. I left that out, didn't I? I didn't mention that. I'm rich. I am. I've got a bathtub where I live. That puts me in the top 30% of the world. I know where I'm going to eat tonight. I know where I'm going to sleep tonight. I know what I'm going to wear tomorrow. That puts me in the top 25% of the world. Oh, and here's one that will really impress you. This computer down here, that's mine. That puts me in the top 5% of the world. I'm rich. Anybody else in here rich? You get my drift. Here we are with so much. Now, some of those people were doing fine, but I suspect that many of these people were living in levels of poverty that we don't even comprehend. I mean, many of these people, I suspect, were working 6-day weeks, 15 hours a day, simply to have something to eat at night. Yet they were tithing. Why would I want to do less? I got to looking at something else. I wonder what would happen if Christians nationwide got serious with God. What if we fell in love with God 10% of the way? What if we started giving God 10% of our income? Well, here's what would happen. There would be more than $220 billion extra dollars given in churches this year alone. That means the average-sized church in America, and by the way, the average-sized church is less than 125 people, would have more than an extra $400,000 given this year. What do you reckon you could do around your place with another $400,000, $500,000, maybe $1 million or $2 million this year? You think we could reach a few more people for Jesus, relieve a little bit of suffering, advance the cause for Christ in a pagan world? We could rock this world, folks, if we would just simply fall in love with God 10% of the way. I think a second principle of godly giving is this. We need to understand that giving should be a joyful experience. You know, sometimes, folks, we get so heavenly minded, we're no earthly good. That's the truth of the matter. We get so religious that we don't understand how basic the Bible really is. Paul said, let each one of us do just as his purpose in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion. Why is that, Paul? It's because God loves a cheerful giver. You know, we read the Bible and we don't catch the humor in it. Paul doesn't use the word cheerful. Does anybody know what this word is in the better translation? What is it, brother? Hilarious. Paul is essentially saying, hey, Christian, get to the point where you jump up and down and click your heels together and say, yippee skippy, I get to give. Now, again, it's real easy for me to teach this stuff. It's not been easy to live it. I can tell you that going back to about 1977 or 78, God taught Bonnie and me a very important lesson about this thing. Really, it was me that needed the teaching. Back in those days, back in 77, 78, this was right after Bonnie and I had started the business. And those were tough, tough days. I mean, we had nothing. And for those of you in here who have started businesses, you know what I'm talking about. Bonnie was working with me. She was averaging over 70 hours a week. I was averaging right at 100 hours a week. I think we went for 7 years without a real vacation. It is tough to start a company. Well, anyways, we were working with this. We had no money. The company account, I recall, had about $3,200 in it. That was it. I mean, and that was there in case the bottom fell out. Well, anyways, I got a call from my friend Bill Turner. He'd been my roommate at college. He and his wife and another couple, Victor and Ruby Ellison. How many of you in here are around Sunset? Anybody down here know Victor Ellison? Victor and their families were living up in Illinois at that point. Victor had just become a Christian. This was before he went to India for 16 years. But Victor and Bill called me and he said, Steve, Victor and I need to come down to Nashville and spend a couple of weeks and raise some money. We need to raise $3,000 to buy a bus for a new church that we've started up here. And I said, well, great. You guys come down here and stay with us. And they did. They came and moved in with us. And every night, Bonnie and I would get home, I don't know, 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and we'd say to them, hey, guys, how did it go today? And every night it was the same old thing. Well, we wouldn't talk to the elders over here. They didn't have any money. Wouldn't talk to the elders over here. They didn't like buses. Wouldn't talk to the elders over here. They didn't like us. You know, it was one thing or the other every night. But the bottom line was the bottom line. These guys were like getting zero. And I'm not real sure when this happened, but it was probably about the middle of that second week when some really bad stuff started to dawn on me. I started to realize, hey, these guys are about to leave town. They don't have any money. I've got $3,000, and I'm married to the only woman on the planet that has never had a dime that she didn't want to just give away to somebody. So being the highly spiritual young man that I was, I started praying harder. I started asking God to help those selfish elders come up with some money. Because I didn't want to have to do it. Well, anyways, the last day came, and the guys didn't have a penny. Have you ever been like this? You knew what you needed to do. You didn't want to do it. And you were half mad at the whole deal. Have you ever felt like that? That's where I was. I'm thinking, well, shoot, I wish I hadn't even invited them to be in the house. They could have stayed at a hotel. I wouldn't have known about this problem. But anyways, I struggled and struggled with it. And finally, I went over here and got the checkbook, and I wrote out a check for $3,000 painful dollars. And brother, I'm telling you, that thing like stuck to my hand. Here, take that thing, Bill. And he went driving out of town with what I was thinking of as my money. Well, give me a minute. I want to get back to that story in a minute. But this business of me being a cheerful giver has not been an easy sell. The third great principle of godly giving is this. We need to understand that we should give as we've been given. Paul said, let each one of us put aside and save how, Paul? As he may prosper, so no collections be made when I come. You know the really cool thing about God? God has never one time ever asked anybody to give something that he didn't give them in abundance to begin with. That's the cool thing about our God. And that's what makes the difference. Listen, some of you in here have the gift of giving. You know, over in Romans chapter 12, Paul lists several different gifts. One of those gifts is the gift of liberality. Some of you have that gift. Now, it doesn't mean that you're rich, and it doesn't mean that you've ever used your gift. But some of you in this room have that gift. If you do, God bless you. Get busy. Start giving in a big, big way. God will bless that. Some of you don't have that gift. If you don't, give what you can afford to give financially. But then look for your other gifts. Some of you, I heard you, some of you in here can sing beautifully. I can't sing. My voice has been known to kill small animals. I am a terrible singer. When I start singing, they start collecting money to find the cure. I am terrible. But if you can sing, God bless you. Get a guitar. Start a band. Sing in the shower. I don't care what you do. But bring your voice to the fellowship. and bless the other Christians. This is that koinonia, fellowshipping, that sharing that we talked so much about yesterday. This is what we need to understand. We need to give as we've been given. God has always made arrangements for everybody. I mean, in the old days, God expected the wealthy Jews to come to the temple with lambs and goats. But the poor ones, they could come with doves. They could come with pigeons. God has always made room for everybody. That's the neat thing about our God. I think when we get our giving right, I think we're going to see at least four blessings that are going to follow. The first blessing that I think comes with godly giving is simply put, is that giving frees us from the tyranny of money. I don't know any way to say this, just to be honest with you, except just to give me just a second here. I'm realizing that I forgot something a little earlier. Y'all just talk amongst yourselves for just a second here, because I just remembered something I'd forgotten. Anyways, what I was starting to say was this. You know, giving, I think, frees us from the tyranny of money. A lot of us are all hung up, stressed, and worried about our money. And when you get right down to the bottom line, for a lot of us, it's because we haven't trusted God. We talk about how we trust God for eternity. The question is, what about the nasty now? The beautiful by and by fine, but the nasty now, we're not too sure about. I see Christians all over the country who are struggling with their money. And when you ask them the hard question, how is your giving coming? They say, well, I don't have anything to give. Folks, if we don't trust our God enough to step out in faith and give, what can we expect Him to do? And the fact of the matter is simply this, and I don't mean to be harsh, but we are on dangerous ground, brothers and sisters, anytime we consistently and habitually kick sand in God's face on anything. When God has told us to do something or not to do something and we ignore Him habitually, we are asking for Him to deal with us. The Bible says God's going to rebuke and chasten every son He loves. I'm convinced that there are Christians all over this country that are in financial stress, that are in emotional pain, relational troubles, even with health troubles, because they have chosen to disobey God. And no, I'm not saying because you're having problems in your life or because I had 5 heart bypasses, I told you about that yesterday, that somehow it was because of sin. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that God knows how each one of us ticks, and He knows how to deal with us. And He will if we ignore Him. But when we start to give, we start to let go. We start to see peace and joy coming back in our lives. I think another blessing that comes from godly giving is it helps us stay involved in the lives of other people. You know, the cool thing about our money is our feet have a way of following it. Back 30 years ago, we got interested in mission work. And I started sending a little money here, a little money there, and at some point it occurred to us, you know, we've sent a fair amount of money to some of these missionaries. Maybe we ought to get our feet energized and go and see some of them. And I'm telling you, this turned out to be one of the greatest blessings in our lives. I had an opportunity to take our children. We homeschooled our children, so these were great field trips. We took them all over Russia and Poland and Germany and North Africa and Central America and Mexico on a lot of trips that we probably would never have made had we not first sent our money. Folks, it is so easy these days at the end of the day to get in our cars and roll up the windows and kick on the radios and drive home and ignore people around us who need our help. But when we get our money involved, we tend to get our bodies involved. And that's one of the blessings that I think comes with godly financial giving. The third blessing that comes with giving is giving just simply brings personal blessings. Now, I don't know any better way of saying it than to say this. Look, if you want to wait until you die and let somebody else take care of your stuff, if you're going to wait until you're horizontal and toe-tagged and let somebody else go through your closets and pull your stuff out and give it all away, I guess that's your right. But boy, that sucks all the fun out of doing it. It really does. You might have heard the story. You might have heard the story about the very unpopular, about the very unpopular little pig. Nobody liked this little guy. So one day, the very unpopular pig walked across the barnyard to where the very popular cow lived. And the pig said to the cow, "Cow, nobody likes us." The cow said, "Well, I'm sorry." The pig says, "Well, there's no good reason." The cow said, "Well, tell me about how pigs give." The pig said, "Well, we pigs, we're great givers, we are. They cut off our little rumps, they call those hams. They whack off our sides, they call that bacon. And they take our feet and pickle those. You see, we're great givers, we are, we pigs." The cow said, "Well, I can see that you give, but maybe there's a better way to do it." The pig said, "Well, how do you cows give?" The cow said, "Well, we cows, we give milk, we give cream, we give butter." The cow looked at the pig and said, "Pig, do you see the difference?" The pig said, "Nope." The cow said, "The difference between how pigs give and the way cows give is we cows do our giving while we're still alive." That's the key to joyful giving. Being around to see other folk enjoy it. It changes everything radically. Now, listen, I think that there is a fourth blessing that comes from godly giving. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know how to teach this one. I have never signed anybody's creed, folks. And I'm not going to. Because what I believe today about some stuff is not what I believed 5 years ago. And if God lets me go a few more years, I'm probably going to change some more. So all I know how to do at any given moment is teach the very best I can. But I would tell you this, I think that there is a relationship between giving to God and receiving blessings back from God. Whoa, Steve, are you telling me that you agree with those guys on the radio that say, send me $1,000 and God's going to give you $100,000? We talked about this yesterday. No, I don't. I call those guys the gospel greed merchants. They're trying to play God like he's some kind of a cosmic slot machine. And I think that it's wrong. It's greed-based. It's a sinful theology. Paul warned about the constant friction between men of depraved mind and deprived of the truth who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. Then he warned that the love of money, that's the root of all evils. And some people, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a pang. But, brothers and sisters, with all of that said, the Bible brings a beautiful balance to all of this. Jesus talked about it. Jesus compared it to a bushel basket. He said, give, it'll be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, they will pour into your lap. For whatever measure you deal out to others, it will be dealt to you in return. Paul said, now this I say, he who sows sparingly shall also reap sparingly, but he who sows bountifully shall reap bountifully. And folks, listen, there's only one place that I'm aware of anyways, in all 66 books of the Bible, where God ever one time told his people to test him on anything. Now, this occurred about 450 years before Jesus came on the scene. It was at a really bad time for the Israelites. The prophets, the priests were on the take. They were corrupt. The people had left God in their hearts. And God was angry. God speaks through the prophet Malachi. Watch this. God says, will a man rob God? Now notice this, brothers and sisters. God considers it robbery when his kids don't give. He says, will a man rob God? Yet you're robbing me. But you say, how have we robbed thee? And God answers, you've robbed me in tithes and contributions. Brothers and sisters, this should scare some of us. You are cursed with a curse because you're robbing me, the whole nation of you. This gets back to what I was saying a while ago. I really believe that there are Christians all over this country that are in horrible situations because they are ignoring God's teaching, not just on this, but on various things. We have got to take our God seriously. But watch what God says. He goes on. He gives them the solution. He says, but bring the whole tithe into the storehouse so that there may be food in my house and test me now in this, says the Lord of hosts. He says, you get your giving right and test me and see if I don't bless you in three ways. Number one, with general blessings. If I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you a blessing until there's no more need. Number two, he tells them that the crops are going to come in. This was an agriculturally based economy. He says the crops are going to come in. Then I will rebuke the devourer for you so that it may not destroy the fruits of the ground, nor will your vine in the field cast its grapes. And number three, he tells them they're going to be at peace with the other nations. And all the nations will call you blessed, for you shall be a delightful land. Now folks, I told you I wanted to come back to that little $3,000 gift that I gave Bill. And I don't have this whole thing figured out. When I get to heaven, I've got some questions I need to ask God about this one. So all I can do is just tell you what happened. You can draw whatever conclusion you choose. I will tell you that after Bill and Victor left town with what I was thinking of as my money, I was one scared guy. I was thinking, man, I'm just going to have to work that much harder, try to replace that and hope nothing goes wrong. Let me tell you what did happen. Bonnie and I noticed in the coming days, weeks, months, that clients began to pay their bills more rapidly than ever before. We noticed over the next couple of years and following that people started coming to us asking us to represent them whom we would never have dreamed would have come to us. This was an advertising and public relations firm. We had a radio and TV production division to it. I can tell you also that over the next 20 years that I owned that company, to my knowledge, we never had a significant cash flow problem. We never had a layoff. And I think I'm telling you correctly when I say that when you factor in payroll, we never had a money-losing quarter in our history. Now, again, I don't have this whole thing figured out, but here's what I suspect happened. I have a feeling that back in the 1970s, God looked down into the heart of a 20-something-year-old kid who had a lot of spiritual growing up to do. And he looked at me and he thought, you know, that old boy didn't have a very good attitude with that check writing thing. But at least he signed it. Now watch what I'm going to do. And it was like I had just cracked the door to God. And he filled it with his light. Did God owe this to us? No way. But brothers and sisters, this is the God we serve. He is so good. He is so almighty. He is so abundant. He is so capable. He is so sovereign. He knows exactly what each one of us needs. He knows the DNA of each of our souls. He knows exactly how much He can give us, how much He needs to hold back to protect us. Listen, I don't think it's going to be until we're on the other side of forever that we're even going to have a clue of all the times that God has protected us. We talk about how we trust Him for forever, yet the question is, what about the here and now? How many times has He held our babies and kept them from things that would have killed them? How many times has He kept that drunk 5 feet across the line that was passing us at 60 miles an hour? This is the God we serve. We can trust Him with forever. We can certainly trust Him with what we've got here and now. And we've talked a little bit about the A, learning to acknowledge who owns everything. Let's talk before we end this morning a little bit about the B of budgeting. And again, budgeting is the bad word of money. I know that. The number one reason why small businesses, by the way, crash and burn is because of bad record keeping. Now, they tell us that the reason families go down financially is because of medical expenses. That medical expenses get too high and then people bankrupt. Well, technically, that may be true, but if you look at the records, the reality is the average family who bankrupts on medical expenses is bankrupting on amounts of less than $12,000. Now, that's a lot of money, but when we're doing our money stuff right in our families, $12,000 should never be enough to kick a hole in the side of our financial bucket. The truth is the reason families go down financially is the same reason businesses do. They just haven't planned adequately to stay out of trouble. You know, nobody would think about building a house or even a building like this without a blueprint. But all over America, every month there are millions of us who get our paychecks, we put them in the bank, we start writing checks, we start paying bills. But we don't have any kind of a written spending plan. And then when we run out of money before we run out of month, we're back in that same downward spiral of stalling the collectors and living off the credit cards. That's what's destroying us. Is this thing in some people's ways? Let me move this over here. I know that board there is a little low and hard to see. How much did I jump ahead on there? I punched the wrong button while I was doing that. Let's see here. Is that where we were? Okay, good. Well, then it just went where it was supposed to. Let me give you three reasons why people don't like to budget, okay? First reason folks don't like to budget, they say, Steve, I just don't know where to start. Well, that's fair enough. In just a couple of minutes, I promise everybody in this room, we're going to know where to start. I will tell you this. It's going to take a combination of two things. It's going to take a little bit of head knowledge. It's going to take some heart information, heart knowledge. And I'm telling you, getting this information and this motivation together, that's the longest 15 inches in the world. But we've got to do it. We've got to get our head going. We've got to get our heart going. I'm going to give you some head information, but I will tell you that about 90% of the deal gets done right here in the heart. We've got to get it together. Now listen, for those of you that want to do a budget, you are going to have to purchase some things. And if you want to, you might write these things down there in the corner of your book just so you'll have them. Everybody in here that's serious about this, that wants to do a budget, you will have to purchase a sheet of paper. You will have to purchase a pencil or a pen. And if you're a big spender, go down to Walgreens and drop $5 and buy a cheap hand calculator, okay? They had them on sale the other day for $1 a piece. You don't need Quicken. You don't need TurboTax. You don't even need a computer. If you want to use those things, that's great. I love them. But you don't need them. What you need is a little information, a little motivation. I'm going to show you about that in a minute. But the second reason people don't like the budget, they say, Steve, I'm just... Now, this one makes me a little angry, to be honest. They say, Steve, I'm just not a geek. This money stuff kind of confuses me. You know, that's kind of like saying, you know something? I'm not a French chef, and I don't know how to prepare Chateaubriand, so henceforth, I have decided from today on to no longer eat food. Who would do that? You don't have to be a French chef to go home and make a peanut butter sandwich. You don't have to be a CPA to do a budget. All we need is a little information, a little motivation, and we've got to get those things going together. But by far the biggest reason why people don't like the budget, they say, Steve, budgeting is just such a downer. It's such a negative, depressing thing to do. I mean, we associate budgets with all kinds of bad things. We associate budgets with things like diets, root canals, pain, austerity, scrimping. Like after we get through here today, some of you go out to lunch together and somebody comes up to you and says, hey, why don't we go to Applebee's? And you're on a budget and you go, budget, and that means that we had to go back over here to the hotel and eat cheese and crackers. And if the cheese hasn't molded, I can't eat that yet because I'm on a budget. I mean, there's some of us in here that actually think that that's what a budget is. And it's little wonder we don't want to have one of these things. Well, I'm telling you, having a budget is not like that. Having a budget means some cool things are going to start to happen. It means we're not going to be stalling collectors anymore. It means that we're going to have money when good causes come around. Oh, here's one right here. It means we're not going to regret the gifts we bought at Christmas when the January bills come. You know what the longest walk in the world is? It's the one from the house at the end of January down to the mailbox. That had better be Jesus. Down to the mailbox. I'm sorry. Down to the mailbox. And you open it up, you pull out all these bills for stuff that you bought for people that you halfway know. You know, actually, come to think of it, the longest walk may not be the one down to the mailbox. It may be the one going back to the house looking at all these things. Again, these are things that you bought for people that you barely know, that by now have either given it away to somebody else or traded it back in for the cash, but you have the honor of paying for the next year. Having a budget stops that stuff. Oh, here's one that's happened to me. It means the waiter's never going to come back to your table and wave your card around in front of all your friends and say, hey, this thing didn't clear. Have you got a good card? Having a budget stops that stuff. And here's one that would be a hoot for a bunch of us. No more fights with our spouse over money because we've got this stuff under control. Listen, maybe what we need to do is reframe the argument. Different words. For instance, we don't have used cars in America anymore. These are all pre-owned autos, right? And the good folks in the TV world tell us we don't have TV reruns. These are encore performances. And bless their hearts, did you know that we don't have late charges from the credit card companies? Those are just service fees. Doesn't that make you feel better? Well, I got to thinking, why don't we rename budgeting? Instead of us calling this thing a budget, why don't we call it what it really is? It's our personal financial freedom plan, or your PFFP for short, if you like that. I like that because it is personal, it's about our finances, and it will give us freedom if we will just plan. So let me just share with you real quickly the 9 keys to developing a successful personal financial freedom plan. Now listen carefully, please. This first one does not even apply to you if you're not married, okay? But if you're married, listen up. The first thing this is going to require is teamwork. And I told you yesterday, and I'm in it, I'm not a very politically correct guy, so here goes. I don't even have an exit up here. Listen, don't get mad at me. Let me just tell you what I believe. Here's what I believe. I believe that the day the preacher said you are now husband and wife should have been the last day that there was his and her money in your marriage. Period. End of sentence. End of paragraph. I do not understand these idiot girls that will marry some hairy-legged old boy and say, well, he's going to be the head of my house, but I ain't going to trust him with my money. Or these dumb guys will marry some old girl and say, well, she's going to be the mother of my kids, but I ain't going to trust her with my money. I mean, where does that come from? The Bible tells Christians that we have all things in common. Folks, Christians who have built-in escape plans, his and her money, prenuptial agreements, and stuff like that are the same Christian marriages that will use those things when things get bad, usually somewhere between year 5 and year 12. We don't need to do this. And listen, I want to be real careful about this. There are some exceptions. I was working with a woman a while back, and I cannot remember whether her husband was drinking it or drugging it or gambling it or what he was doing. But I finally told her, I said, listen, you and the kids have got to get your money. You've got to get a checking account and get your payroll into a checking account so you and the kids will have some rent and grocery money that you can depend on. But, folks, this wasn't God's first plan. We were doing triage. We were doing the very best we could with what was left of a family to try to hold what there was left together. But from the very beginning, I'm convinced that God has always wanted husbands and wives to be together. Now, with that said, I will admit that in most marriages, there are two very different people. Very different, okay? In most marriages, there is, financially speaking, in most marriages, there is one person whom I like to call the money geek. And this is the person who really digs this stuff. This is the person that doesn't mind to go over here and spend 4 or 5 or 6 hours crunching the numbers. They really like this stuff, okay? This is the person in every marriage who has no wife, okay? But there's usually one of these. But also in most marriages, there is another very different type of person whom I call the big spender. And the big spenders make it their goal to be sure that the hole at the bottom of the bucket is always bigger than the one at the top of the bucket. And it's those big spenders who are the ones who drive the geeks crazy. That's not a bad look. You could do that. His face is turning the same color. I'll get it off. Listen, I don't care which one of these two you happen to be. But if you happen to be the geek, congratulations. You get to run point. And geek, this is when you need to get a good budgeting form. Those of you that got copies of the No Debt, No Sweat book, and by the way, I've got a few more copies up here. Yesterday I told a class, and I do this in situations like this. The book is usually $19.99. It's a $20 book. I've got some up here that if anybody after class wants one, you can have one for $20. You can have one for $10 if you want one. But in the book, we have a really good budgeting form and a ratio breakout of how much to spend on different stuff. But there are a lot of other good books out there that have good budget forms. Just get one. And geek, go over here and you spend the 5 or 6 hours, whatever it takes to make you happy, put this thing together. But geek, once you have the plan kind of worked out, you have got to come back over here to your big spending spouse. Now listen up, big spender. This is the first time in your marriage, and I know that big spenders hate these meetings, but this is the first time in your marriage that you can't play that old game of saying, oh honey, you're better at that stuff than I am. You just handle it. You can't do that. You can't abrogate. You must participate, okay? But geek, remember, the big spender hates this meeting, so do it right. You know what most geeks do, don't you? Most geeks come in with this armload of paper, walk in and say, it's time for the money meeting. Come on. And which room do they always go to? The kitchen, yeah. Come in the kitchen and to the kitchen table and phoom, drop all that down, turn on the fluorescent light, and sit down on separate sides of the table, glare at each other like you're at a union management negotiating meeting. Bad strategy. Don't do that. Listen, better plan is this. Geek, get this whole thing down to 2 or 3 thin sheets of paper and say, darling, could we get together and talk at such and such a time? And the other person, the big spender, says, okay. And then when that time comes, don't go in the kitchen. Go somewhere where you can sit side by side, like the living room. Or better yet, go to the bedroom. And don't turn on any lights. Light some candles. Turn on some pretty music. Use some bizarre words. Sweetheart. Darling. Kissy poo. Whatever works. I don't care. But sit there and go through this gently together. Now, I'm telling you, you do this the right way, it can be the beginning of a very cozy evening, if you know what I'm talking about. You do this the wrong way, it's the beginning of the second great ice age, so get it right. Number two, we need to know what our true income is. This, you know, a lot of times I'll be talking to a couple and I'll say, so how much do you make? And they'll say, I don't know. Or they'll say, well, you know that WD-40 form that the boss sent me, or the government, or the guy at the post office? That said we made $50,000 last year. Ding, 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 ding. Wrong. That ain't what you made. That's what they call the gross income. And the reason they call that the gross income is because that's how we feel when we realize we ain't getting all that money. That's before they take out the federal tax, the state taxes, the Social Security, Medicare, union dues, and all that junk. And by the time they're through mucking around with your $50,000, it's starting to look a lot more like $40,000. But we need to know what we've got to work with so we know what we can do. Number three, let's do our personal financial freedom plan on a monthly basis. Now, Steve, does this mean I have to spend 6 hours every month messing with this thing? I hope not. Now, listen, I hope everybody in here realizes what I'm teaching on this, is not anything new, right? I mean, this is very similar to what Susie Orman, Dave Ramsey, Larry Burkett, Ron Howard, or not Ron Howard, Gomer, Opie. I meant to say Clark Howard, but, you know, some very well-known people teach very similar stuff. Now, I packaged this a little differently, but it's pretty similar stuff. But here's something that most people don't tell you. When you start on this personal financial freedom plan, make a 6-month commitment. Because here's what's going to happen. I'm just telling you right now, it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. You two will probably have more fights in the first couple of months of this than you've been having before. You will have grown to hate that Gomer Pyle lookalike that you heard from in Tulsa that talked you into doing this. But give it 6 months. And usually within 6 months, the waters are placid and life has changed for the better. If you don't like it, you can always go back to the old-time havoc, but give it 6 months. Number four, We've got to do our personal financial freedom plan in written form. Folks, there is no such animal as a budget that's not on paper. I don't care whether we're talking about a budget or a new law or the constitution of a nation. Until that sucker is reduced to writing, it's nothing more than a bunch of free-floating ideas out here in wide open space, ready for revision with every little whim that comes around. You have got to put it on paper. Absolutely. I get really spooked when I'm talking to a couple and I say, well, so you have a budget? Guy will look at me and go, yep. Oh, can I see it? No. Why not? Because I keep it right here. That guy doesn't have a budget up there. He doesn't have much else up there. You don't keep your budget between your ears. You have got to get this thing on paper. Number five, we're going to write our personal financial freedom plan in the order of priority. This is when we say to ourselves, hey, if I only had $500 coming in this month, what would be job one? Would that be my giving, my housing, my clothing, my food? Great, then boom, pop, put that at the top of the list. What would come next? Then what would come next? Listen, I have yet to have a month when I didn't run out of money before I ran out of things that I would like to do. At least this way, we pay the rent before we pay the cable bill. Very important. Number six, let's not be overly optimistic. And again, one of the funny things that happens, there's usually one parent, this is the geek, who is secretly happy that we have finally got our budget going. And this is the parent, you know, just has a way, who has a way of kind of destroying the fun and the family and everything else. Same parent that would make a great Hitler youth camp guard, okay? And they call the kids and they say, come on in here, kids. Your mom and I, or your dad and I, we've decided that we're going to start a budget. Now, what does that mean to you boys? Well, that means starting next week we're going to sell the dog and you boys are going to start eating the kibbles and bits. And from there, kind of goes, don't do that. If you do that, you're telegraphing to the next generation that this is not going to be something that's going to be any fun, anything to enjoy. We are going to find ways to enjoy life. We may not get to go out to some of the fancy restaurants for a while. You know, the ones with the salt and the pepper and the separate shakers. We may not do that for a little while. Dad, you may not get to play as much golf. You may have to come home and throw a frisbee with the kids. That's not all bad. But we are going to find ways to enjoy life and still have our personal financial freedom plan. Number seven, sort of a first cousin of this, is be kind to yourself. Listen, whenever I do one of these seminars, I know what it's like. It's a little bit like a bell curve. There are a few people that come into these rooms that don't want to be here. You're sitting here right now wondering, you know, I wonder what I'm missing over there in that better session across the hall. But you made a mental calculation before you came in here that it would probably be less painful to come to this class than to deal with your spouse if you didn't. So you're here, and I'm glad you're here, okay? Now, there are some of you in the middle, a bigger group, that will do some of the stuff that I'm teaching. There are a few of you over here on what I call the lunatic fringe. You're my best friends. You're the ones that are going to do everything that we're teaching, and in 4 or 5 years, everything's going to be different. I'm talking to you right now. Be kind to yourself. When you start this process, don't expect it to work miracles overnight. For instance, if you've got some item in the budget that you've been spending $100 a month for, don't throw it in here in the new budget for $40, because you'll keep spending $100 and in a few months it will become a budget buster and we'll be blaming the budget rather than the spending habit. Be kind to yourself. Be gentle and do this in a gradual way. Number eight, let's not forget the set-aside items. Most of us have some things that we don't purchase every month. A lot of us, for instance, pay for our car insurance every 6 months. A lot of us pay for, notice I'm using the phrase pay for rather than go on. I don't like this attitude of entitlement that we have in America. A lot of us pay for a vacation once a year. But if we don't have line item set asides where we're putting money away in advance, then what will happen? One of those things will come around and we won't have the money to do it. Or we'll do something really stupid like using our vacation or our credit card to buy a vacation in advance. That's what gets us back into the trouble. Number nine, let's learn to distinguish between what is essential and what is optional. And that is extremely hard to do here in Disneyland. Because folks, most of us believe that what is completely essential is what we've already got. Plus about 10%, right? But the truth is, the essentials are housing, clothing, food. After that, everything else is an option. I was working with a woman a while back, sweet lady. She was divorced. She has 2 children. She was a school teacher. The collectors were calling her, and she was all stressed out. And she called me. I said, well, do your budget. We'll get together. And she did her budget. I looked over it, and under the heading of cable TV, she had everything. I mean, not just the poverty package. I mean, she had the whole thing, Showtime, HBO, and all that. Now, we could talk in here for a few minutes if you wanted to. We won't. But we could talk about whether Christians should even be buying HBO and Showtime and some of this stuff. But that's another lecture. We won't do that. Anyways, I looked at all that stuff and I said, well, surely, you know, you could get rid of all this cable TV and I forgot, in 10 months, 11 months, you'll be out of debt. And it made her mad. She sat there and lectured me on why she had to keep it. It was essential. And I didn't argue with her. She kept it. And things got worse and worse. And eventually, several years later, it took her years to get out of debt. But if we can see the difference between what's essential and optional, that helps a lot. Listen, let me share with you what I call the Diggs family secret weapon. And again, I'm doing this totally tongue-in-cheek. This is not a secret. This is probably one of the most widely taught money control techniques that's out there. How many of you in here are already using an envelope system? Good. Boy, I'm among friends. That's great. For those of you that aren't, let me show you how this thing works. By the way, if you want to, you can go down to the store and spend $15 and get a cool little kit. Or you can do what we do. We spend 15 cents and get these cheap little envelopes. They work just as well. And what you do is you look over here at your personal financial freedom plan, and you identify those 10 or 15 or 20 different things that you know you're probably going to overspend on. I'm not talking about things like utilities, but maybe things like eating out at restaurants. I call that recreational eating. Allowances, the money you give the kids, the gifts that we buy for other folk, the gas that we put in the car. You now know that you can get an FHA loan for the gas, right? groceries. And then what you do is you look over here at your personal financial freedom plan under restaurants. You say, oh, I've got $50 I can spend this month on restaurants. So cool. You put $50 in here. And then after church is over, somebody comes up and says, hey, why don't we go to McDonald's? All you have to do is get over here and look in your envelope. And if there's money in here, what do we get to do? Yeah, we're going to hit the golden arches. But if there's nothing in here, what are we going to do? Cheese and crackers. Or if you prefer, crackers and cheese. But we're not going to spend money that we don't have. And by the way, a little trick that will help you here is if you've got like $50 for your restaurants, for instance, don't start the month out by putting a $50 bill in there. Trouble is, you'll go somewhere and spend six and pocket the 44 and forget what happened. Put small bills in. It works a lot better, I've learned. Now, tomorrow we're going to pick up in here and we're going to talk a little bit about controlling our money. This is when I'm going to show you how to build what we call the wolf barrier. The wolf barrier is a, and you can see it in your books, it is a 10-stone wall that's designed to keep the wolf away from the door forever. How to develop the emergency fund. How to deal with it if you should suddenly lose your job. What do you do about paying for buying insurance the correct way? What do you do about getting a job fund together? How do you prepare for college expenses? And by the way, moms, dads, let me just tell you something. I've got some unusual things to say about paying for college. I do not believe, like I told some of you yesterday, I do not believe this old line that says that just because we hatch a kid that we owe that kid a college education in 18 years. I'm going to show you some alternative ways to pay for college. We build a wolf barrier by getting ready for a dignified retirement. We build it by learning how to become legacy builders, givers on a long-term basis. Now, with all of that said, if we get through tomorrow in time, we will have a little bit of a Q&A period, a little time when we can talk together, and I would be honored to visit and answer any questions or respond in any way that you need from me to. Let me just say this before we break huddle. I do have some copies of the No Debt, No Sweat book. This is the basis of the seminar. This book now is in its ninth printing. And it's a 350-page book, 19 chapters, and this is the soup-to-nuts book of what Christians need to know about money, how to be out of debt in 1 to 4 years, how to do the budget, how to become the givers God wants us to be, how to quit fighting over money, what to teach the kids, how do you do the practical things, the home buying, the car buying, the insurance, how do you invest correctly for retirement, how do we pay for college, all of that. Anyways, these books, like I said, are normally about $20, and they're more up at the we have them discounted some, but they're more expensive up at the booth. But anybody in here that would like one of these, as long as I've got them there, I've got some here for $10. And if you would like to listen to the entire seminar, we have a few sets of this down here too. This is a 4-CD set. CDs, not DVDs. 4-CD set. These are normally $36, and these are, if you'd like one, these are $24. You can just see me down here. And if anybody would like to discuss or learn more about a No Debt, No Sweat seminar, I've got some literature here I can give you. I'll be up at the booth, be glad to talk with you about it. And with that, let's just bow our heads. We'll talk to the Father, and we'll break huddle here, okay? Father God, thank you so much for loving us like you do. And Father, thank you for bringing us together. I just pray, Father, that you will cover us with your arm of grace, that you will bless the rest of this day, that we will be holy people, that will hold up the torch for Jesus. It's in His name we pray and praise you. Amen. God bless you guys. Thanks for being here.